Good afternoon, everybody. How is the sound? Because some people say that this is a weird room and the sound sometimes isn't good. So, but everybody's hearing, everybody in the back and the front. I notice that my voice sometimes falls away at the end of sentences. So if that happens and you can't hear, just wave your hand and I'll know what that means. I will try to keep my voice up the best I can. So I hope, this is great to see so many of you still here sitting. You didn't run away, you didn't go do other things, you're still here. So that's great and I'm very happy about that. And I hope you have had a good day of sitting so far. You know, who knows what happens to people when they decide to spend the day in silence on their cushions. Maybe you can explain it to me sometime. But it's probably very different for different people. And the mind maybe wanders. Maybe you have a thought occasionally as you're sitting and the mind is wandering. Maybe you came expecting that you would have a peaceful day and it's frustrating because it's not so peaceful. You have a lot on your mind and you're trying to quiet your mind and it's not working. Wouldn't it be nice if you could say, mind, think like this, and it would. Wouldn't that be good? But it doesn't seem to work that way. You'd think that it's your mind, right? Why aren't you in charge of it? Sometimes you find that out when you're sitting here all day. But then again, I bet that some of you have found some peace today. Maybe a flash, a moment, maybe even 5 minutes of actual peace. Very, very precious. I hope that this is true for every single one of you, that you found some peacefulness today in between the thoughts coming and going, and they appear, of course, in the mind because you have a complicated life. So thoughts come, but in between the thoughts, maybe in that little space between the thoughts, there's some peace. Who knows what worlds are there in the spaces between each thought as it comes and goes in your mind. We think that the thoughts are our thoughts, but I'm not so sure whose thoughts they are. They appear out of nowhere, and then suddenly they're gone, and then there's another one. This is very, very odd, isn't it? But maybe you've noticed how profoundly odd this is. So this afternoon, I would like to continue my ongoing discussion of the Gandavyuha Sutra, which is the 39th and final chapter of a much longer sutra called the Avatamsaka Flower Garland Sutra, which itself is one of the most extensive and imaginative of all the Mahayana sutras. And there are lots and lots of Mahayana sutras. If you were here at our sitting last month, maybe some of you were, you could possibly remember that last month I spoke about one of the cases in the Book of Serenity, case 67, that references the Avatamsaka Sutra, and I talked about the sutra a little bit last month. It's possible that you were here last month and you have no recollection of that. even more possible that you weren't here last month. Therefore, I'm going to say a word. Those of you who are used to all of these things, I say a word of introduction, and my apologies to those who've heard this before. So, the Avatamsaka Sutra depicts a vast almost incomprehensibly vast world of infinite Buddhas that exist on every single atom of matter in many world systems, including this one. And on each atom is a Buddha, and each Buddha has their respective retinue of bodhisattvas and other listeners and supporters, various enlightening beings who are serving these Buddhas and are practicing tirelessly on behalf of sentient beings who they love and want to protect. That's the world of the sutra. It's certainly far beyond this world that we live in with Facebook and automobiles and food, stuff like that. And yet, as our Chan ancestors taught us and explored in so many ways, this objective physical material world is not anything other than the world of the sutra. In fact, the world of the sutra is the essence of this world, only we don't notice it because we have other things to think about. We're not noticing what's really happening on every moment. And although it might seem at first as if the world of the Avatamsaka Sutra is fantasy and couldn't be more irrelevant to the very serious problems that we have right now, not only in our personal lives, but in the world at large, I don't think that's the case. When times are tough, it is really important to know how to keep your head above water, how to live in the world with your eyes wide open to the real problems and do whatever you can do about those real problems, and at the same time, not to be limited by our small views, and to understand and have a real grounding in the fact that human goodness, cosmic goodness, and the possibility of love and creativity is always there right in front of us if we're open to it and if we allow it. When times are tough, it's very easy to forget about that. And when you don't forget about that, this means that there is never a good reason to lose hope, because you understand that hope is literally built into the nature of reality, no matter what is going on. And the Avatamsaka Sutra is one of the world's greatest religious visions of such goodness and such hopefulness. And that is why, even though it seems crazy, we are studying it exactly in these times. We started this study this time, because we've studied it before. This time we started it in the beginning of the month of August. And so by now we're well into it. And I know a number of you have been following along. And those of you who have not been following along can certainly join us if you want to. Every Wednesday we meet online from 5 to 7 p.m. in the Pacific time zone. And every second and fourth of those Wednesdays we're also in person. All the talks are posted online after they've been given, so you can catch up to the talks if you're interested. Or you can listen to them after they're given each week if you're not able to listen live on Wednesdays. And everything you need to know about how to access all of this is very easily found on the Everyday Zen website, which is everydayzen.org. So there's no problem if you want to get involved in this. You might not want to get involved in this after you hear my talk, but just in case you do, you can. So this final chapter of the sutra is the longest chapter, and it's often, as are many other parts of this sutra, the sutra is so long that some parts of it are almost circulated, have been circulated as independent texts, and this one has been often considered an independent text called the Gandavyuha Sutra. And it's the story of a bodhisattva who goes on a pilgrimage to visit 53 spiritual benefactors to receive teachings. And eventually, at the end of the 53 benefactors' teachings, he ends up entering what is called the realm of reality. That's another title for the sutra, the realm of reality, which is the ultimate reality shared by all the Buddhas. And the 53 benefactors are all different kinds of people. Some of them are monks, some of them are kings, there's a whole bunch of goddesses, there's a grammarian. You always need a grammarian. Two of them, for some reason, are perfumers. There's wealthy people, there's beggars, all kinds of people, young people, old people, in all sorts of situations. But each of them is equally possessed of fabulous wisdom, which is described in many pages of detail, and mystical powers. And each of them exists in vast worlds within worlds of insight and vision. And each one is also humble enough to, after they've given their whole fabulous teachings, say, well, that's what I know, but what would I know about? And then they give a whole bunch of other things, and then they say to Sudana, so go forth to the next person where you'll find out about this, because I don't know anything about this. Since Sudana has his sights set on complete and utter awakening for the benefit of all beings, he is full of enthusiasm, and he's willing to go to any lengths to see the next spiritual benefactor, who he always asks, I want to achieve complete enlightenment for the benefit of all beings, but I don't know how to do it. Can you tell me what I need to do and how to go about it? And then they tell him. And no matter how many teachers he visits, he always asks the same question to the next teacher because he's constantly starting over again. He's always at the beginning, full of innocence and passion to do absolutely everything that can be done to awaken on behalf of everyone. Because all bodhisattvas know, and this is exactly what makes them bodhisattvas, that it is impossible to awaken alone. The idea of individual transformation is basically an oxymoron. There couldn't possibly be any such thing. And that is why compassion is the hallmark of all bodhisattva precepts. All bodhisattva practice. And this includes Zen, which is a Chinese form of Mahayana Buddhism. And because it's Chinese, it's very down to earth in its literature and in its style of presentation, very modest and very understated. But nevertheless, it is Mahayana practice, and all the Zen masters knew this sutra. And you'll remember that that's so after the lecture is over and we chant the four great vows, where we will vow to save all sentient beings, although there's an infinite number of them. One of the most important teachings of the sutra is the 10 stages of a bodhisattva's journey, the 10 practices bodhisattvas develop along the long course of their endless development. So this afternoon, I want to briefly talk about these 10 practices and then read you a little bit about the story of one of Suddhana's spiritual benefactors, just to give you a flavor of what the sutra sounds like. The 10 practices are called the 10 paramitas. And the word paramita means perfection, the 10 perfections. So these 10 practices represent the perfection of human conduct and human understanding. But the word paramita also, by a probably somewhat spurious etymology, which is often used anyway, means to go beyond. So we translate prajna paramita as wisdom beyond wisdom. The 10 practices are practices that go beyond themselves. They're not limited to what they seem to be. They're beyond what they seem to be. And the 10 practices are giving or generosity, ethical conduct, patient endurance, or sometimes called tolerance, joyful effort, sometimes called energy, meditation, transcendent wisdom that sees the true and boundless nature of all phenomena, skillful means, which is the ability to see into beings' natures so as to assume any shape or form in order to help them. Vows, the great determination and resolve to keep on going no matter what, to be of benefit. Spiritual powers, which in this case maybe involves the power and strength to master all these practices and teachings and so on. And the last one is knowledge, which in this case means full understanding and openness to everything and everyone. So those are the 10 practices that bodhisattvas perfect. If you think about these practices for a moment, you realize that every one of them involves engagement with others for the purpose of loving and benefiting them. These are not techniques for improving one's life or performance, though, of course, if you do practice them, they're going to cause you to go beyond your usual life with all of its self-generated trouble. So, in that sense, your life will improve, no doubt, but who cares? That's not the point. Well, these 10 practices are, that's a tall order to do all of this. And this is one of those cases where, you know, you hear spiritual teachings and they go in one ear and out the other. What does this have to do with anything that I'm concerned about? On the other hand, you could say that if you do pay attention to them and think about them and reflect on them and consider them really, you might be inspired. You might be spurred on to do great things, things you didn't thought you could do, didn't think you could do. So the practices, when you think about them, are very aspirational and helpful in that sense. But I do think that in a very down-to-earth way, one could take up these practices. You could really practice them. You really could figure out how to practice them, and this would change your life. Maybe you couldn't practice them in some idealistic way like they sound in the sutra, but you could practice them in a very concrete way as you are in your life. It's really possible to do, and many people do it. Make your best effort to practice in this way. The first six paramitas are very common in Mahayana Buddhism and much discussed, and I'm sure most of you here are quite familiar with them: giving, morality, forbearance, energy, meditation, and wisdom. And I know that we can practice these. We can make an intentional effort to be generous. That can be done. That's not hard to do. Not only in the literal sense of being generous with stuff, give our time, our energy, our resources, as many of us do, but also to view this question of generosity more broadly, to live generously, more expansively, more open-handedly. And we can practice generosity in our sitting. What would it be like to be generous and open with yourself on your cushion? Not to be critical and crabby and have a dim view, an ungenerous view of what arises in your heart. Since giving is the gateway to the Bodhisattva path, we can focus on giving maybe more than any other practice. And there are so many ways, once you start noticing, so many ways that the mind has of being ungenerous all the time. So you practice noticing that. And whenever you see it in your mind, to try to open up, to try to let go of those small and stingy habits of mind. Maybe we could just forget about all the other 9 bodhisattva practices and just practice generosity all the time. And I'm pretty sure that would be enough. I don't think you'd need the other 9. Because I think they would follow if you were thorough enough in your practice of generosity. And that's true of all the bodhisattva practices. Every one includes every other one. Every one thoroughly practiced brings to fulfillment all the others. Ethical conduct is classically defined as following precepts. And more or less, in Zen, precepts means kindness and consideration for others. To do your best not to do and say anything at all that would hurt others, not even to think anything at all that would be ungenerous or hurtful to others, but instead to act lovingly and beneficially. And ethical conduct in this case is not viewed as a kind of restraint, you know, don't do this, don't do that, don't do this. It's the opposite. It's a beautiful way to conduct ourselves that's most true to the gift of being human, what we really, really are as human beings. To be true to that is to be ethical in the most beautiful sense. Because we come to realize that every impulse to create harm to ourselves and others comes from our past conditioning, our woundedness, and our fear. Patience, or tolerant forbearance, is the practice of facing what occurs without turning away or grasping. Mostly it has to do with our capacity to receive suffering when it comes as a path of growing and developing, rather than a tragedy that somehow should not have happened and will limit us. And the way to practice this is to pay close attention to how we are when things happen that we do not like. and to try our best to meet those things and those feelings instead of trying to get rid of them or recoiling from what's happened or pitying ourselves and thinking our lives are over because of this or that that happened. Joyful energy is the practice of knowing how to manage ourselves so that we can always find a way to make a positive and diligent effort, even if we are tired or sick or old and messed up, and even if things around us are very tough. There's always a way to have the mind rising up instead of sinking down. And so, again, we pay attention to the times when our energy flags and how that happens, and to understand that, and with patience, and little by little, to learn to do otherwise. And this buoys up our spirits, and we feel happy when we can practice joyful effort, even when we're in a fix, or a mess, or we're tired out, or we're very old. Not that anybody here is old, but in case they got old. Meditation, well, I don't need to say anything about that because we've been practicing that all day, trying to focus the mind, making the effort to bring the mind back. Whoops, come back. Whoops, come back. Whoops, come back. You nasty mind, come back. Whoops, come back again. Dogen famously says, and in most of my Dharma talks I say, Zazen is not meditation. And that's true. But in this case, let's call it meditation. We are doing meditation today. And it is a very important thing in all versions of the Buddhist path to cultivate a calm and a stable mind. And this takes persistence over time, and the way to do it is not by trying to beat your mind up. That doesn't really work. You know, it's interesting to try to do that for maybe a decade. And then afterward, after the decade is over, say, yeah, that's right, that didn't work at all. But I'll save you the trouble and tell you, don't do that. Just be gentle with yourself. Persistent, firm, gentle. Don't force anything. But also, don't goof off. Transcendent wisdom, prajna paramita, is simply seeing things the way they really are. Impermanent, radically impermanent, and without essence. Everybody knows this, that everything is fleeting. All the time, everything is fleeting. Every thought dissolves, doesn't it? And then something else happens. Every moment passes. This is an unfailing truth. Every moment passes, and we're lucky if another one comes. So we know there is absolutely nothing that you can hold on to. There is absolutely nothing that remains as it was. And with prajna paramita, it becomes very clear to us that all of our human problems come from our mistaking things, thinking of things as being other than they actually are. So this is a subtle wisdom that we see sometimes in flashes, and we develop it over time, the wisdom of emptiness. So those are the six paramitas that we have discussed many, many times. I even have a book about them. The world could be otherwise, but there's probably dozens of books on the six paramitas, and everybody says a little something different. So contemplating the six paramitas is a good thing to do. The 10 paramitas, there are actually paramitas, and they call them paramis in Pali. And there is a list of 10 paramis in Pali, but they're different. It's a different list. And I'm not sure where the four additional less well-known paramitas come from, but they might actually come from the Avatamsaka Sutra, because the Avatamsaka Sutra was put together over many, many hundreds of years, and the earliest versions of the sutra are quite early, appear very early in China. So it's possible that this is the sutra that introduces the 10 paramitas. In any case, the last four are more cosmic and somehow lofty and ambitious than the preceding six. They are the practices of the lofty bodhisattvas, these cosmic archetypal beings in archetypal realms, where they visit countless Buddhas in the Buddha realms and make extravagant offerings to them and learn and memorize their many, many teachings and practice them and master them and vow to serve and save infinite beings and to keep on going until every single last one is a Buddha. So that's where these four paramitas come from, that sort of sense, that inspiring, vast sense of the practice. And I think that we are meant to understand, as I said before, that this vast universe of Buddhas is actually our lives. That we can do this, and we are doing it already, although we don't see that we are. There's so much, and we've often in our Dharma seminars gone into, in detail, Mahayana Buddhist teachings, which have very cogent and sophisticated analyses of time, space, and consciousness that are actually pretty persuasive in showing that our limited way of viewing ourselves and the world couldn't possibly be the whole story. That there must, of course, there's more. In Mahayana Sutras, reality is not just random. Reality is the cosmic drama of universal awakening, universal redemption that's actually happening in each and every human life and in each and every moment of every life. So the last four paramitas, these bigger paramitas, are skillful means, vow, spiritual powers, and knowledge or omniscience. So this is interesting to think about. To practice skillful means really is practicing seeing the world not from your side, but from the side of others. Because we look at the world and we think we're seeing the world, but we're not seeing the world, we're seeing our point of view on the world, aren't we? How could we be seeing anything other than that? Right? What is the world, one Zen teacher asks. Good question. So what would it be like to see the world not from your side, but from the side of others? In other words, not to have a set of values and principles that you expect yourself and the world and others to adhere to, else you disapprove. And you will find, in that case, quite a bit of disapproval, won't you? But instead, to gaze at what is with compassionate and sympathetic eyes, so that you can see what the world and others are doing from their side, not yours. So that you can harmonize always with anything and everything. Might be bad, but what are you going to do? Here it is. And then, this is the skillful means part, when you harmonize, then you can gently dance with things, lovingly, with an embrace, so that little by little, things as they are can be brought to the good. Not by any forcing, but through support and kindness. And that's what life could be like if you practiced like that. Bodhisattvas are characterized by two things more than anything else: compassion and vow. And these go together. Loving beings and wanting to protect them, you are determined to do so and you vow to do so. And vowing is not like an objective promise that you make, like a New Year's Eve resolution. Dry January. That usually lasts until the 5th or 6th of the month, or whatever it is. That's not what a vow is. You know, I will do this. I did it. I am to be congratulated. I feel good about myself. Or, more likely, I didn't do it. I feel bad again, but I'm not to be taken seriously anyway. No, that's not what a vow is. Vowing is an infinite commitment for the good, even beyond a lifetime, with your whole heart to care for the welfare of others and the whole world and every world, and to dedicate yourself, thought, word, and deed, to that ultimate welfare. So one way, and I'm trying to, you know, kind of give some thoughts about how this can be make sense in terms of the world we live in. So one way you could look at this is to see the practice of vowing as the opposite of the normal practice that we do. And the normal practice that we do is called me. That's our practice, right? What's your practice? Being me. I'm me. That's my practice. Self, that's my practice. So this is the opposite. I mean, we do think of ourselves, don't we, as persons distinct from other persons. And who doesn't want to get what they want and need and to get rid of all the stuff they don't like? I don't do that. That's not me. Because being me, we want to protect and magnify me, so I would feel comfortable and good. Even we practice Buddhism. We say, Buddhism is good. It's good for us. It will help us get what we want. It will help us be happier, be better adjusted. I'll get rid of all my dissatisfaction and trouble. It'll be really good for me. It'll get me what I want. So practicing vow is like being a spiritual surgeon. You make an incision and you remove the self and you stick the vow in to the same spot and hook it up to all the organs. So that life is no longer organized around what you want and need, but instead is organized around the vow to be of benefit to others, to practice and go on practicing with that motivation. That's actually, you could do that, actually. And if you do, you'll discover that it's a much nicer way of living. A lot of the problems that you had because you were pushing and hauling and shoving and it wasn't working to get you what you wanted, you don't have that problem anymore. Living according to the self, the real dictator, is exhausting and frustrating. Perhaps you've noticed. So that's vow. Next comes spiritual powers. In this case, as I said, the power or the strength to master all kinds of teachings and to miraculously help beings in all kinds of ways. And the 10th paramita is knowledge. the capacity to understand beings' tendencies and their real natures and to master all the teachings that can help them. And the way I look at this is that it's a real, what it is, it's a kind of openness to reality in all its forms, whether you like them or not. You're open to what is. You don't close down. You don't deny. You don't run away. You include and you support everything that's in front of you, and you learn from it. And you understand how to relate to everything according to its true nature and to the applicable Dharma teachings. Anyway, for some reason I thought, what will I talk to these guys about? And I thought, well, you can never go wrong with the 10 paramitas. So I brought that up. And it is one of the underlying rubrics of the sutra. And the sutra doesn't anywhere list the 10 paramitas like that and discuss them the way I discuss them. It always discusses everything in terms of stories and characters. So I thought I would end with a little part of the sutra just to give those of you who have not read it a little taste of what it's like. And I'm going to read a little part from one of the 20th teacher that Sudana visits, whose name is Sarvagaman. And he is the teacher that his story is meant to illustrate the last practice that I just talked about, the practice of knowledge. So, as always, it begins with Sudana looking for this guy. And he enters the city at sunset, going from block to block, street to street, looking for the mendicant Sarvagaman. And in the still of the night, he sees a mountain called Sulaba, north of the city. And the mountain peak was adorned with thickets and groves of various plants and trees, as bright as the sun. And when he saw that light, Sudana was ecstatic. And he thought, no doubt, he's up there. So he went up there. And he found him. And he asked him, how can I practice? And Sarvagaman answered, it is good that you have set out for supreme perfect enlightenment. I am established in the enlightening practice of going everywhere. I have attained concentration of all-observing vision, and I am imbued with the light of knowledge of transcendent wisdom, which distinguishes all planes of the cosmos without effort, based on non-being. In wandering through all worlds of living beings and inanimate objects, in wandering through the realms of existence of all beings, in the occasions of death of all sentient beings, in the occasions of birth of all sentient beings, in all kinds of conditions of existence, in the various places of rebirth, the worlds and abodes of sentient beings of various appearances, forms, and sizes, bound to various kinds of existence with various aims, wedded to various views and courses of action. This is still the same sentence now, and you've lost track of where it started, didn't you? Because I sure have. Believing in various forms of religion, I work for the benefit of sentient beings by various means and various applications of knowledge, period. Some I help by teaching various worldly arts, by means of the light of mental command of all kinds of arts. Some I help by charity, kindness, assistance, and cooperation to lead them to omniscient knowledge. Some I help by describing ways of transcendence, generating the light of knowledge, of dedication to omniscience. Some I help by praising the aspiration for enlightenment, producing a basis for preservation of the seed of enlightenment. Some I help by describing all facets of the practices of enlightening beings, fostering the commitment to purify all Buddha lands and perfect all beings. Some I help by frightening them showing them the misery and pain resulting from evil actions. Some I help by delighting them, telling them about the fruit of omniscience ultimately developing from giving gifts to all bodhisattvas. Some I help by describing the virtues and qualities of all Buddhas to generate desire for the qualities of Buddhas and determination for omniscience. So on and so on and so on. It goes on for a while. I'll skip a bit. Furthermore, in every street, every block, every house, every district, every family and group, I assume forms like the men and women, boys and girls in those places, like all of us. We may be unwittingly sarvagaman, right? We think we're so-and-so, born in such and such a date. We don't realize, actually, we're mentioned here as a person in a house, in a district, a boy or a girl, a man or a woman. They don't know who's teaching them or where I'm from. They just practice truthfully what they have heard. And I go everywhere on this continent to those who are immersed in the views of false doctrines in order to mature those who cling to various views. That's just a little taste of what this sutra is like. And I have been, if you go to the Everyday Zen website, there's a link to a way of reading it online. It's available online. And if you want to become perfectly deranged and start to live in other realms than this one, I've been practicing reading the sutra every day, almost every day. And it's wonderful, you know. You leave this world behind and you fly off into the space. And then you come back to the world and you say, oh, not a bad place. A beautiful sun in the sky, a beautiful moon at night, gorgeous fellow human beings to gaze at, and a body that moves around. You say, go up the steps, it does. You say, go down the steps, it goes down the steps. For a little while you feel, what a world. Anyway, I recommend, if you're a hardy soul who wants to take this up, you can do it. So, as always, those of you who are new to us today might not know we do this, but we do. We have discussions after my talk is over. Instead of questions, we have discussions. And we get into groups of three. And we just self-organize here in the room and online they organize. And we get into groups of three. And we do usually 3 or 4 minutes for each person, a monologue. And you just speak as honestly as you can. There's no, thing you're supposed to be thinking about any of this. You should think whatever you think and say so. So everybody gets to talk as honestly as possible, and the other two people are just listening, and then they speak in turn. So that's what we're going to do. And then when that's all over, we usually have a few minutes that we all get together again and see what everybody has to say. So here's what I'm asking you to speak about today, if you are willing. And you can, of course, you're free to speak about anything that's important. Maybe there's really something really important to you and all of this is completely irrelevant. Talk about that thing that's important to you, if you're willing. Otherwise, what do you think of all this? That's my question for you. Honestly, what do you think of all this? And the important thing is to be honest. If you think it's wacky, I don't say it's not. So say whatever you really feel. And should it be the case that you hear something in it, that you actually, one thing, maybe somebody hears one thing that they think, ah, you know what, I can take that up, I can practice with that. What is that one thing, and how will you practice with it? Two things, if there's two. Okay, so what do you make of all this? And is there something in what you've heard that you can actually apply to your practice? So with that, everybody's going to find groups of three. And we always say it would really be a good idea if you're an old timer, because the room is a very mixed group of people who've been doing this for decades and other people who are fairly new. Try to mix it up so that old timers and newer people can be in the same group. But we don't have much time to move chairs around, so in a few minutes, let's organize ourselves.